It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Governor Evers recently unveiled his plan to help struggling dairy farmers. We'll look at what he's proposing and how it might affect Wisconsin's dairy industry. First, having friends over for dinner can be a super fun way to catch up and share a meal. But when the time comes to put it all together, you might feel a little bit stressed out. Well, you don't need to be overwhelmed. Our next guest joins us to share some ideas and recipes that take the anxiety out of making a meal for friends. Allison Roman is a chef, columnist, and cookbook author. Her latest book is Nothing Fancy, Unfussy Food for Having People Over. Allison, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Your book is chock full of recipes, Allison, but a key thing here is it's also an attitude, a mindset. Can you talk about the having people over mindset you're trying to help us find?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that you see that. I definitely view it as a state of mind as well. I think that it's, for me, sort of the difference between entertaining and having people over. And for me, entertaining feels really stressful and scary and fussy and uptight, all things that I am extremely allergic to. But having people over just kind of just makes you feel a bit more relaxed. It makes you feel kind of like, oh, I can do that. That's different. And I think that, you know, embracing that from the beginning is going to help you no matter what it is that you're cooking.
Yeah, entertaining sounds like, okay, you got to, whatever, iron the doilies and polish the candelabra, or buy doilies in a candelabra, I don't know. you don't think it has to be a production, right?
No, I don't. I think that it can be as fussy or, you know, opulent as you want it to be, or if it just means like ordering pizza and then making a really good salad to go with that, I feel like that's also having people over.
And you've got some advice in your book, again, even before you get to the recipes. One of those is ask for help, even with the little stuff. Why do you think it's hard for us when we're having people over to say, hey, can you do this one little thing that's part of the deal?
Honestly, I think it all sort of boils down to our need to feel perfect and in control of the situation at all times, kind of in every facet of our life. But there's sort of something that happens when you invite people into your home that you want to make sure that, like, every corner is well vacuumed and that all your plates match and that whoever's over is going to see this version of your life that you want it to be, right? That nothing ever goes wrong, that everything's clean and you have plenty of time for everything. But I think there's something really nice about being a little bit more vulnerable and kind of just letting people see what your life is really like and understand that we're all just doing the best we can. And, you know, reframing that, what it means to invite people into your home, is not a scary thing, but as just an extension of building relationships and, you know, making better connections.
And I love you. You kind of say we should pick our battles. And part of how that plays out is, hey, if you want to make it fancy, do not a fancy main course and fancy hors d'oeuvres and fancy this and that. Do one thing that's fancy and keep everything else super simple.
Yeah, it's kind of like how I approach my wardrobe, right? I'm not going to wear head to toe extremely expensive things. I may buy one nice, you know, pair of shoes or a bag, but the rest of it's going to probably be like, you know, a Hanes t-shirt and Levi's. And I think that there's something in that mixing and matching of just, you know, if you're going to spend the time, if you're going to spend the money, if you're going to spend the effort, do it on like a really beautiful prime rib or some delicious wine or like a fancy cake or something. And then everything else can just kind of accompany that and support that.
And another thing you encourage is forget the main course. Have a meal that's snacks and side dishes and things like that. And honestly, if I'm eating, you know, if I'm just making food for myself, I love to eat that way. Why not share that with other people?
Yeah. I mean, snacks for dinner is probably my favorite meal. And people say, what's your favorite thing? It's, you know, snacks as a general category. I think that, you know, we have this sort of, still this like, I think very antiquated meat and three and like, you know, meat, starch, potato, meat, vegetable, potatoes type of mentality when we think of how to build a meal. But I think a meal of, you know, a roasted vegetable side dish and a bowl of grains and a salad and then, you know, cheese to start is awesome and a really filling and, you know, great way to have dinner. I promise you nobody will be hungry.
Allison Roman is with us. Her new book is Nothing Fancy, Unfussy Food for Having People Over. We've got some recipes Allison shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's get to one of those recipes. This is something, it sounds like something that your friends expect you to make, this dip. Labneh, am I saying that right? With sizzled scallions and chili, in parentheses, almost ranch. Tell us about this one.
Yeah. Yeah, labneh is, I think, the way that I said, or labneh, depending on where it's coming from. But basically, this is like my highbrow version of ranch dressing. And this is something that I crave all the time. You know, some version of like a sour cream and onion dip or ranch or just that creaminess with, you know, kind of a garlicky and then lemony flavor. And to me, this is the best of those worlds, except I take scallions and I sizzle them in some olive oil and I add chili flake and I cook that down into this bright, beautiful orange chili oil with like the scallions kind of melted into it. And then I swirl that over the top of really lemony labneh. And if you can't find labneh, which is not everywhere these days, but you can use sour cream and you can use full fat Greek yogurt. Both work really well.
And this is, we could use this anywhere where we might use ranch dressing, which is just about anywhere these days, right?
Yeah, it's a bit thicker. So I definitely see it as more of a dip than a dressing. But if you were to thin it out, it could definitely be dressing worthy. But it's, you know, the kind of thing that I set out in the bowl for snack time and you can dip vegetables into it or, you know, flatbreads or crackers. But it's also really good, you know, spooned under roasted vegetables or eaten with a roast chicken.
Now, Allison, in this recipe, and I think at least one more, you introduced me to a culinary term I'd never heard before, frizzled. What is frizzled?
You know, frizzled is like not quite crispy. It's a bit closer to sizzled, but there is browning. It's not caramelized. You know, I think of something as frizzled, I think of it more as a textural thing. So the one I think you're speaking of is the frizzled chickpeas.
Yeah.
And chickpeas, people are obsessed with getting crispy, which is actually quite hard because there's so much water in them. And unless you're roasting them for a very long time or you're deep frying them, it's pretty challenging to get them crispy. But frizzled is something anyone can do and as long as you have enough olive oil. And I kind of take that same approach to the scallions. They're not really fried and they don't get crispy, but they are frizzled. They're like, you know, a little frazzly crispy around the edges maybe, but still pretty tender.
That is how my attempts at fried, you know, crispy chickpeas have come out. I guess I will embrace that. I always hit a point where I give up on crispy and just go with, I guess, frizzled.
Yeah, don't fight it. Frizzled is great. Love a frizzled anything.
Now, here's another dish. It's a side. Now, there's already a stain on the copy of the cookbook here because our producer, Jay Carlisle Larson, made this one at home. Creamy cauliflower and onion gratin. Tell us about this one.
Oh,
it looks
yeah.
really good, and I'm getting good reports from JC.
It is fantastic. It's basically like a mac and cheese, but with cauliflower. And it's really simple. There's no technique, really. You're just layering in raw cauliflower, onion, salt and pepper, into a baking dish or a cake pan or kind of any vessel that has, you know, sides to it. And you're covering it with cream. There's some Gruyere cheese or I think white cheddar. I forget. You could use either. plenty of salt and pepper. And then you cover the top with a sesame breadcrumb if you want. It's also really great without the breadcrumbs. I wanted there to be sort of a gluten-free or, you know, wheat-free alternative to a gratin, which tends to always include flour and a bechamel or breadcrumbs as a topping. And this one is really just cauliflower that you cook in cream in the oven. So as the cauliflower cooks in the cream, it becomes super, super tender, almost custardy. And the cream cooks down and evaporates and gets really decadent and rich. And to me, and there's not a better side dish.
And you write that there's this trend out there to replace pasta with vegetable replacement things. And you are generally against that trend. But in this case, you like it.
Well, I say this is not that because I don't want anyone to think that I would ever think that you should not eat pasta or eat a vegetable in favor of a pasta or vice versa. I think that they're both their own beautiful things and should be enjoyed separately. But this is more like, you know, taking a piece of cauliflower, which is not the sexiest vegetable. It's pretty mild, you know, it doesn't have a ton of flavor, especially when just, you know, steamed or anything like that. But when you cook it in a ton of heavy cream and Parmesan or Gruyere or cheddar, then I think it takes on an entirely different role.
Is there a food that doesn't get good when you cook in a ton of heavy cream or Gruyere or anything like that?
I can't think of one, honestly.
We're talking to Allison Roman, chef, columnist, and cookbook author. We're talking about her new book. It's called Nothing Fancy, Unfussy Food for Having People Over. She's with us to talk about sharing a meal with friends without getting overwhelmed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you go into having people over for a meal with this attitude? Doesn't have to be fancy. The house doesn't have to be completely clean. You don't need a five-course meal with a lot of effort in each one. What kind of things do you like to serve? What is your go-to, maybe quick and easy thing for if people are coming over on a work day say. Or if you have a question for Allison, you need some recommendations, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And remember, we've got some recipes from Allison over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our Food Friday conversation with Allison Roman, chef, columnist, and cookbook author. Her latest book is Nothing Fancy, Unfussy Food for Having People Over. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like having people over for meals? How big a production do you put into it? Do you get stressed out, excited, both? Are there some go-to things that, you know, are big crowd pleasers that come out pretty easy for you? Or would you do it more, but you think it's going to be too much work? Maybe you need some encouragement, a pep talk from Allison. Or maybe you've got a pep talk of your own for having people over. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Allison, before we get back to recipes, back to the attitude side of things, I'll say sometimes I may be reluctant to have that dinner get together because of the work it entails. Do you worry that, you know, the mindset that we have to do something cool and fancy every time is just keeping us from doing it at all?
Oh, constantly. Yeah. I think people are always looking to kind of, you know, put a spin on something. And like, you know what's really good? A regular chicken that is seasoned with salt and pepper and put in the oven. Like, I don't need to spin that at all. And I think that, you know, kind of putting that pressure to always do something different or unique or crazy is going to often be more trouble than it's worth, in my opinion, and not necessarily delicious than something that feels just sort of classic and comforting. And if that's what you like, then there shouldn't be the pressure to make yourself into someone you're not.
Now, I'm just an ordinary Joe radio host. People don't expect too much from my cooking. As somebody who works in food and writes books about food, do you feel like more pressure than the rest of us might? People are looking at you like, she better come up with something good.
Yeah, actually, somebody just asked me on Twitter if I had a spin on a chicken pot pie, and they brought up a recipe that I had published that was just a pretty straightforward skillet chicken pot pie. And I said, you know, I do love to make things interesting and add a twist here and there occasionally with certain things, especially like vegetables or chicken thighs, you know, for like a skillet dinner. But if I'm going classic, if I'm making a chicken pot pie, I just want that to be the best version of a chicken pot pie. I want it to be like textbook, you know, archetype chicken pot pie.
Now, you mentioned roasting that chicken a little while ago. Another recipe you shared with us is a slow roasted oregano chicken with buttered tomatoes. So, I don't know. In my head, roasting a chicken's a big deal, is it?
It's really not a big deal. I feel like, you know, if you have an oven and a chicken, you can make a roast chicken.
That's all it takes. What is special about this one, the slow roasted oregano chicken?
For me, there's a few things that make this one special. One, I'm employing sort of this low and slow technique, which almost mimics like the rotisserie style where you're cooking it over a long period of time. And what you get there is the skin, it doesn't get crispy, but it does sort of, it renders the fat underneath the skin in a way that you don't get when cooking the chicken at a higher temperature. And the end result is like kind of this really sticky, deeply savory, very thin layer of skin on the top of the chicken. And the meat is just impossibly tender and nothing is overcooked. The breast is really juicy and the thighs and the legs are so tender that you can just literally pull the bone out. And the second thing that makes this chicken so good are the tomatoes that get roasted alongside of it. Because as that fat cooks from the chicken, those tomatoes then get slow cooked in that chicken fat, which is unbelievably delicious. And of course, because I feel like in this particular instance, you can't really have too much of a good thing. There are a few little pats of butter scattered on those tomatoes before it goes into the oven. So the stuff, the little sauciness at the bottom of the whatever you're using, a roasting pan or a baking dish, it's just the most delicious, tangy, savory sort of juices that you've ever possibly had. And so I like to serve it over really thick cut toast. If you're not into toast or bread, you can always leave it out. But this is probably the chicken that I roast more frequently than any other chicken. And just because they're using tomatoes doesn't mean you have to make it in the summer, because the way that they're cooked, they are pretty much foolproof no matter what kind of tomato you're using any time of year. So I think it's like a secret winter dish where you're just wishing to see a vegetable and just so tired of potatoes. You're like, well, I can have tomatoes for dinner tonight, but as long as they're slow cooked in chicken fat.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Karen on the line in Rice Lake. Karen, hi.
Hi. I like to make couscous when I have guests coming over because it's quick and easy, and I can make the stew ahead, and then if I don't know what time the people are arriving, I just make the couscous when the people pull in the driveway, and it's no more difficult than making stovetop stuffing. You just boil the water, put the couscous in, take it off the burner, and wait 5 minutes, and then fluff it.
That's fantastic, Karen. I like that kind of premeditation there, Allison. She knows that she can have this together really quickly.
That's correct. I'm a big fan of every type of dish that requires that little attention.
Great, Karen. Thanks for that call. And Allison, make a point. Hey, if you're worried about you've got five different things, they all need to be hot. Well, maybe don't plan that way. Have one thing you want to keep hot, and everything else is stuff that you don't have to worry about the temperature for.
Yeah, I feel like people are so obsessed with having hot food on the table at all times. And you know what? Honestly, things aren't hot. Nothing has to be hot. I feel like as soon as it gets to the table, even if it is hot, guess what? In 5 minutes, it's not going to be hot anymore. So don't worry about it. I think that most things served at room temperature, which is not exactly a sexy term, is actually really delicious.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Michael now with us in Madison. Michael, hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Michael?
Good. Hey, I was just going to talk about, I'm having about 12 people over this weekend, which is more than I'm generally used to. So my wife and I decided to have everybody make their own pizzas in a cast iron skillet on the stove. And all you got to do is pop it under the broiler for about 4 minutes and everybody will be fed and happy in less than an hour.
That sounds fantastic. And you're going to have just a range of toppings people can choose from, Michael?
Yeah, a range of toppings. You just build it all right in the cast iron skillet. And whenever it's ready, you just toss it under the broiler for a couple minutes and it's done. Everybody gets to try each other's creations, and it's kind of a fun thing we like to do when friends come over.
That sounds cool. And, Michael, not to get you into controversy here, are you going to have pineapple and ham as an option?
I have not picked up the pineapple and ham, though. Thanks for giving me the good idea.
Excellent, Michael. Thanks for that. Allison, that's a great idea. Do you have any other thoughts on, you know, a crowd participation for people coming over, things like Michael's doing?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a control freak, so that would be actually my worst nightmare. But I feel like, you know, having the sort of baked potato bar, which I write about, or a DIY pizza night are really good ideas because I can control certain things in that equation. Like I can make the crust and I can procure the toppings and make sure that any combination of them is going to turn out really well. So also, I feel like when people come over and it is the sort of that pizza night, I'm like, no, you can do it. Just put it on the sheet pan, put it in the oven. They look at me like I'm crazy. But it is also like a de facto cooking lesson, I guess, and just making people feel more confident when they come over that they can actually do something like that as well. But I'm a big fan of the like topping bar concept. So be that a potato or a pizza, I think it's great.
Michael, thanks for that call. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Allison Roman. Her new book is Nothing Fancy, Unfussy Food for Having People Over. We got an email from Pat who says, Julia Child says you should said you should present your food with no explanations or apologies to your guests. Pat writes, I've really tried to remember this and think about how we're honoring our friends with dinner and they want us serving it to them happy. And you, that's another point I didn't bring up earlier. You say you agree with that idea. Don't apologize.
Yeah, never apologize, just as a blanket statement for life. No, just kidding. yeah, I think that, you know, things are not always going to go according to plan. And, you know, maybe something took longer than you thought, or maybe the store didn't have cilantro, so you had to use parsley, or the chicken didn't get as brown as you had hoped. But if your mood changes and they sense that you're stressed out or unhappy, then I think that that changes the vibe of the entire room and the entire table. So I completely agree with that. And putting your best and most excited face forward and embracing the imperfections as they arise is the best way to keep the vibe fun and loose and casual.
And we also heard, we got a note from Grant who says, Stratas are a favorite of mine. Do you have a favorite Strata you like to bake, Allison?
You know, I don't. I'm sure Grant could give me a tip or two. It's typically not something that I make ever. So I've had them for breakfast before, but never would have thought to make one for dinner.
Yeah, it sounds like I make bread pudding a lot, and it seems to be like, well, Strad is just bread pudding, but, you know, savory instead of sweet, but I haven't tried it myself either. So yeah, Grant, we're going to expect a recipe from you. Send one in quickly, please. And then I want to, you know, we're toward the end of our meal here, Allison, so let's get to a dessert. You shared one that you say kind of functions like a Pop-Tart and looks like a pepperoni pizza, but it's still really good. Tell us about it's a sour cherry and sesame galette.
Yeah, and this is another one of those sort of hidden winter treats because I think there's nothing wrong with using frozen sour cherries in something like this. In fact, I think that they can sometimes be better and easier to find than fresh sour cherries, depending on where you live. But it's also really flexible and you can use other fruit in this galette. But instead of making, you know, those open face galettes, which are delicious, but sometimes can be really juicy or too runny, and there's, you know, an improper crust to fruit ratio, I like to make a double crust galette. And someone asked me, what's the difference between a double crust galette and a pie? The difference being that you're not using a pie dish for this. So it is flatter and it is more pizza looking. And I realized after I looked at the photograph that it looks like a big pepperoni pizza, but I think that's funny. So I'm into it. But it's really nice because you can just slice it up and share it with people. And if it doesn't get all eaten at night, it makes a fantastic breakfast.
That's another one we have at WPR.org/Food Friday in our last minute or so. Allison, leave us with a pep talk to get out and try having people over maybe as soon as this weekend.
I think that, you know, if you want to spend time with your friends and you need to eat dinner, obviously, I think that having people over and inviting them to your home is such a better experience than trying to make a reservation at a restaurant where you're stuck next to the same person the whole time and you don't know how the food's going to be and someone's serving you. It changes the dynamic entirely. And I think that you're inherently feeling a bit more close to someone and the conversations get better and the food could potentially be exactly what you want it to be if you just have them over to your home.
Fantastic. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Allison Roman, chef, columnist, and cookbook author. We've been talking about her latest book. It's called Nothing Fancy, Unfussy Food for Having People Over. We've got a few of the recipes she shared with us. You can find them and make them if you'd like. They're at WPR.org/Food Friday. Governor Evers is calling on state lawmakers to pass an $8.5 million package to help Wisconsin's dairy farmers. Evers talked about it during his State of the State address on Wednesday. Then he formally called the legislature into special session next week to take up the plan. The bills are designed to boost exports, award incentives to farmers to diversify their products, and to provide mental health support to farmers after years of tough times.
Between 2011 and 2018, Wisconsin lost about a third of our dairy farms. We lead the nation in farm bankruptcies. We've endured the consequences of unnecessary and unproductive tariffs and trade wars. And we've heard people who've said there's no place for small farms anymore. They ought to go big or bust. Well, they are wrong. They don't know Wisconsin.
Farm industry groups have generally been warm to Evers' proposals, but say they fail to address some key problems. Mark Stevenson is Director of Dairy Policy Analysis at UW-Madison Center for Dairy Profitability. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob. Happy to be here.
Before we get into specifics, what do you make of the focus on farming, agriculture issues, dairy, both in the State of the State address and with this call for the special session?
I think it's great that we're finally doing this. There's so much that, you know, probably can be done. You're not going to save every small farm or operation that you might want to, but there are some things we can do to put in place, I think, some you know, real initiatives for dairy producers to help them through these tough times.
One of the things the governor is calling for is an effort to boost Wisconsin's percentage of the dairy exports from the United States. Can a state really do much to affect that?
I think they can. When we look at the exports from the dairy industry here in this country, the largest exports that we do are skim milk powder and whey powder. Cheese comes in, you know, there after that, a long way down the line, and then some butter. And cheese in particular, I think we would be looking at specialty cheese products as opposed to just commodity cheddars as a good example. And Wisconsin squarely placed for doing that.
Is that a marketing issue? If we sell it, they'll come and buy it?
Oh, it's partly that, but there are just all kinds of inherent problems that you have with this. Many of our smaller cheesemakers that make a high-quality product would just find that this is a customer overseas that's quite a bit different than a domestic customer. We have to learn what they want, what they're expecting in the way of product, how it's packaged. We have to begin to think about, can we assemble a full container load of our product and get it there? That's quite a bit for some of the smaller operations. So coordination is probably one of the things that we need to work on for expanding exports out of the state.
Can we export our way out of our farm problem? Is this something that alone is going to prevent at least a portion of these bankruptcies?
Exports are going to be a great way to help the dairy industry grow, and that's not going to be a permanent solution to a problem, because if we, you know, raise price enough that it's a market signal, you know, that tells farmers we want more of your product, in other words, produce more milk. And of course, farms respond, and then you get the tug and pull, you know, that you have of not enough milk one time and then more milk than you really wanted perhaps another time. So this is part of the answer, but it's not the ultimate solution.
Yeah, one thing that isn't here, and some farmers have looked for this, some of our callers on the show over the years have said, hey, the problem is we're producing too much milk. We need some kind of supply control. Is that something that would be effective and or doable?
Supply control measures that most people have talked about really would have to be implemented at the national level. If a single state decided to do something like that, you do it at your own peril, mm-hmm. because this state might contract or hold the line, you know, in terms of milk production, but that might also send a signal to other farmers in other parts of the country to go ahead and expand and take up that proportion of market share that wasn't taken up here. So it can't happen at a state level.
Another part of the governor's proposal is an effort to help farmers diversify their products. $50,000, I think, in grant form or loans, I'm not sure. What would something like that look like?
Well, that can be a real opportunity for some folks. A good example might have been, 12, 15 years ago when we began to see a lot more organic milk production. That was kind of a new product at the time, and that took some learning, you know, for dairy farmers to be able to do that. But it was a good answer for a number of farms. It helped them maybe stay a little bit smaller in size to have a higher income from that kind of production. And I think what they're really talking about is, are there some other niches that can be explored? Can we help farms begin to think about maybe segmenting a marketplace for milk to address consumer desires?
Talking to Mark Stevenson from the UW-Madison Center for Dairy Profitability, looking at agriculture proposals from Governor Evers in a State of the State address, especially with dairy farming. Another one, not an economic one, but regional programs aimed at helping farmers to access mental health resources, which are often few and far between in rural Wisconsin. This isn't part of the profitability story. Is it an important thing to look at, though?
It is an important thing to look at. You know, this has been such a stressful time. 5 years of relatively low prices. Farms have been prepared, you know, to get through downturns in prices, but they've typically been much shorter than this, maybe a couple of years, and then a rebound. And when a farm is working as hard as they possibly can, and they think they've cut costs as much as they possibly can, and they're still losing money year over year, it's depressing. And when you can't pay bills and people are asking you quite legitimately to have their bills paid, you may need some help. And I mean just in the way of mental help to realize that you're not in this alone.
Now, over the decades, really, centuries maybe, there's been a lot of work at the university through Extension and other programs where there's research that then goes out to farmers. Is there room for more innovation in Wisconsin when it comes to that, where academic resources can be tapped to help these dairy farmers?
No question about it. You know, the production of milk is really a commodity program. And with a commodity program, most individuals can't do much to influence the price they receive for their product. It's just being put out there in the market with thousands of other producers sending their product out there. And the marketplace has to find the price that clears the product. the real key is how do we produce it for less? So the only way to really have a more profitable operation is to find ways to cut costs from it. And there have been historically lots of new ways to do that. Many of those have come from research from universities.
Are there other things you think that the state could be doing, whether or not they're part of the governor's proposal here, that might help dairy farmers?
I think a lot of things that individual organizations can do to help dairy farmers, a lot of things that the state can do and has done already. I mean, I was director of the task force, dairy task force here that wrapped up about a year ago. And there were a number of recommendations that producers and other members of the dairy industry and community put together that have been successful. Some of those have already been employed. Others are in the process of being employed now.
In just a couple moments, Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin is working on this labeling of non-dairy milk, I'll throw it in quotes, products from almonds, whatever. Is that a big factor in what's facing Wisconsin farmers, these non-milk milks?
It's a factor, less for Wisconsin because we don't supply a lot of milk to a beverage or fluid market. Most of our milk goes to cheese here, but, you know, plant-based beverages have certainly displaced some of, you know, conventional cow's milk beverage. And, you know, there's a hard definition for milk, so we need to be respectful of that.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's Mark Stevenson from the UW-Madison Center for Dairy Profitability, looking at Governor Evers' plans to help struggling dairy farmers here in Wisconsin. What if you had the chance to take a long view look at your life on screen? Would being part of a lifelong documentary change how you made decisions, interacted with other people? UW-Madison Professor Nick Hitchin knows what that experience is like.
When I grew up, I liked find out all about the moon and all that.
Nick, a farmer's son, grew up in the Yorkshire Dales.
And I said I was interested in physics and chemistry. Well, I'm not going to do that here.
At 14, he was away at boarding school, and at 21, reading physics at Oxford.
So what career are you going to pursue?
It depends whether I'll be good enough to do what I want to really do. I would like, if I can, to do research.
It's a clip from the latest installment of a British documentary series. You heard Nick at a couple different ages there, as well as narrator-director Michael Apted. The series began in 1964 with 7 Up and has tracked the lives of a small cross-section of English men and women. Updates have come out every 7 years. 63 Up, the most recent, opened in the U.S. in November of last year. It'll be showing in Madison at the UW Cinematheque February 21st and 22nd. Nick Hitchin, who we heard there, came to UW in the early 1980s, has been working and teaching in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Okay.
Well, this is an unusual experience doing this 7 Up project over the years. You said in one of the interviews on the show that it was often emotionally draining to do the interviews. Can you talk about what that's been like?
Wow. Well, how long have we got? I mean, basically, what Apted does is he probes a bunch of topics that, you know, you don't normally probe in polite conversation, and then having it on a broadcast to gazillions of people, it puts you in a place where you're very emotionally exposed and, laid bare. So it's just very an unusually taxing thing, and then you know, he'll come by and you're doing this incredibly intense interview for 2 or 3 days. And then when they're done, they will literally drop you off on the side of the road and say bye. And you stand there going, oh, okay, bye. So, you know, it's just very disorienting. And emotionally, it takes you places where you just don't normally go, at least not in public.
As it happens, I'm 49. I'm a multiple of 7 right now. And looking at your experience doing this, I thought, would I have wanted to do this? And I think probably not. Did you ever think of not picking up the 7 years later?
Not really. I mean, the thing is that, yes, it's actually pretty tough, but it's one of the most interesting things I've ever done. And it's people tell me it's important. What I do in my life is research, and trying to do things, try to come up with something that's creative. And these people have done something that's really, really creative in making this documentary. And so it's really important to me. I mean, the chance to be in it, even though it's uncomfortable, is tremendous. It would be inexcusable, really, from my point of view, to back out of it because it's just so valuable. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah. You've said a couple times in public that you'd want to be known as much for science, maybe more for the science you've done than for the 7-Up series. Can you tell us some about some of the science you've done in your career in England and then at UW-Madison?
Sure. I mean, it's not that, it's not that I have to be better known for one thing or the other. It's just it's a bit ironic that when you put all this effort into trying to be a scientist, you know, you're more well known for being interviewed at age 6. When I was a teenager, actually, I'll put this out there, I read a book about the state of the world's environment, which said that we were going to pollute. You know, this is a slightly different spin on how people would say it nowadays, but we were polluting ourselves into a problem. And, you know, now we think it's carbon dioxide that's causing us the big problem. But I decided then that I wanted to work on something that was going to try and mitigate this. So I and a bunch of other people were fairly early adopters of the whole go green and don't put out a lot of carbon business. That was what we were working on. And I was working on something called nuclear fusion, which was at the time looked like really the best way to try and make cheap, clean electricity where we wouldn't be polluting. So nowadays, I don't think I have to explain the need for that to people. People get it, but in 1970 or so, I'm not sure it was quite as obvious. But the problem was that when I got far enough into it, it became fairly clear to me that this was not actually a practical solution. So I then switched to other areas which are useful and helpful, but not quite as dramatic as saving the world by giving us an unlimited cheap energy source.
Another part of your career is teaching. And in the most recent edition, 63 Up, you talk about your love of teaching. Can you talk about your teaching work at UW-Madison?
Well, there's sort of two parts to that. Our undergraduates are wonderful, salt-of-the-earth types. And, you know, one of my colleagues said that they're life-giving. And I hadn't thought of it that way, but it's a good thing to say. I thought that was a good comment. But they're engineers, so they're very down-to-earth. So, you know, if they're going to give up good beer-drinking time, it had better be a good lecture that they're listening to. And I must have taught, I don't know, somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 undergraduates in the last however many years it's been. And then the other side of it is, I mean, the people I can really put a lot of my heart into are my graduate students because I have more contact with them. And I want to, you know, I mean, they're amazing. They're absolutely amazing. I want to tell you a story. One of my ex-graduate students, I believe, is the world leader in finding a cure for autism. I mean, he basically was doing incredibly well as an engineer, but he had an autistic daughter, so he quit doing engineering, and he's been a leader in showing that the human gut controls your brain, and he's doing, I hesitate to say this on air, but he's doing something that he calls fecal matter transplants, and it's showing tremendous promise as a cure, and he's doing a stage 2 clinical trial. So, I mean, you know, my graduate students are the people who I'm really closest to and who I try and give a leg up. And I'm just telling you that story is an example of how wonderful they are. So, yes, I mean, I'm really, really into the sort of trying to promote the careers and the lives of our students, whatever level they're at. You know, the undergraduates, you do your best. But, you know, the thing is that I'd like to say I was serving Wisconsin, but they all leave Wisconsin, you know. So, I mean, I guess I served their moms, you know. The people in Wisconsin who I helped are you know, maybe these students' families. But I consider it a huge privilege to be allowed to teach these people. It's just wonderful.
In the 7-Up series, people have been following your life since age 7. We can go back and watch things since then. And I imagine people feel like they know you. Do you have a lot of people approach you with a familiarity just based on watching you in the series?
Well, it depends what you mean by approach, because I don't get sort of physical approaches. I get a few emails. And whether they don't usually say that they know me, they often say that they found things they could relate to in their own lives. And every now and then I'll say something that really strikes a chord with somebody. I told a story once about my brother being deaf and how I was wanting him not to be deaf. And then I realized, well, I was actually wishing him away by doing that. And I got a letter from a woman who said she had a son who was somewhat handicapped, and this just had meant a tremendous amount to her. So, you know, that letter from her right there was enough to justify doing the whole blummin' film. I mean, I showed it to ActEd, and I don't think he was quite as excited as I was, but he was pretty pleased with it too. ActEd is the director, for what it's worth. Yeah, so I mean, occasionally you get people come up and say, you know, I know you from somewhere, and you can't really say to them, oh, you've seen my movie. You know, that feels a little bit much, but no, most people around me are not terribly aware of it. It's just goes along very quietly in the background. And so a few, you know, I guess a lot of people have seen it on Netflix or whatever, but we don't talk about it all that much.
Well, and you say in, I think it's in 63 Up, that it's your story, but in a way, this long view of a life, it's telling everybody's story. Do you feel like there are things just by the sheer process of looking at your life regularly like this that we could all learn something?
I definitely do. I don't mean that to be me. I don't mean that you can learn from me, but I mean, I am just, in most ways, just every man. And it's a unique way of looking at the human life. You know, it's like doing time-lapse photography of a tulip blooming or something. You don't normally see that perspective. And if we saw that perspective more, we would have much more insight into perhaps how choices you make at one point in your life affect things later on and so on. It's just a very different way of looking at things. And that's why I think it's so important. And in a way, the details don't matter all that much, because the things that are common are what really matter.
Can you leave us? Do you have any kind of advice for the rest of us? I'm not going to go to the trouble of being in a documentary every 7 years. Nobody's asked me to, for that matter. But do you think you've learned lessons on how the rest of us can reflect on our own lives?
That's a real... that's a stumper. I suppose that... What I was saying a minute ago about if you did have this long-term perspective, you would have a different view of of a human life. I mean, I suppose that the striking thing, I mean, I suppose one thing is, you know, the choices you make do have these huge consequences down the road. So I don't know. Maybe the bottom line should be live as if you're having a documentary made about you. I mean, but that's a little bit trite. But I mean, I think that a lot of people probably don't think long term, and this might encourage you to have a long term perspective. That would be the best thing I could offer up right now.
Nick, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was UW-Madison Professor Nick Hitchin from the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. He's featured in a decades-long documentary series that's followed the lives of the same group of British people since they were children. You can see Nick in the latest update. It's called 63 Up. That'll air in Madison at the UW Cinematheque February 21st and 22nd. The Milwaukee Bucks have had a great season so far, and today they are taking it on the road, way down the road, with a game today in Paris, France, against the Charlotte Hornets. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson has been to Paris a time or two. Hey, Judith.
Hey, bonjour.
Now, what are great things for people to do in Paris if they're really tall?
Well, as you know, Rob, that's right in my wheelhouse.
Right. Very tall executive producer, Judith.
No, very not tall. Actually, the first thing I thought of was they should definitely not go to the catacombs. Very cool, but they will for sure bump their heads on, you know, dead people's bones. Yeah, so not that great. But I was thinking about the Musée d'Orsay. It's an old train station, so it's very, you know, wide open in area. It's got one of those super cool, like, ginormous clocks on one end. So I don't think they would feel too scrunched in there.
Okay, and give us some language advice. How do we say fear the deer?
You would say craignez les cerfs. Cerfs are like deer with big horns, which is their actual.
Exactly. Okay.
So literally fear the stag, fear the deer.
Does that, say it again. See how it rolls.
Craignez les cerfs.
Okay. Yeah. It's got a nice roll to it. Okay. And slam dunk.
And you're going to like this one because it's faire un smash au panier. So a smash on the basket.
Nice. I love it.
Yeah.
All right. Why aren't we on assignment there right now?
Good question.
Close-up WPR coverage of the Bucks in Paris.
Yeah. Next time.
Next time for sure. This is Central Time. It'll be a slam dunk or a
smash au panier.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.